Hey there, my name's Mark McCartney and welcome to the What is a Good Life podcast. Over the last 3 years, I've interviewed over 200 people around this question, not to prescribe a universal answer, but to help you to find and define your own answer to this question. Well, I'm hoping the guests' curiosities, exploration, stories and experiences prompt your own inquiry into this question. Well, I'm also trying to share with you what I perceive to be more genuine expressions of the human experience and indeed meaningful conversations. Which brings us to this week and the 67th episode of the What is a Good Life podcast, and I'm delighted to introduce David Haskell as our guest. David is a writer and biologist. His most recent book, Sounds Wild and Broken, is a finalist for the 2023 Pulitzer Prize in nonfiction. His previous books, The Forest Unseen and The Songs of Trees, are acclaimed for their integration of science, poetry, and rich attention to the living world. Among their honours include the National Academy's Best Book Award, John Burroughs Medal, finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and many more. He is a Guggenheim Fellow and a professor at the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee. In this episode, David shares his journey with celebrating all living life, experiencing life as much through his senses as possible, while becoming aware of the connections between himself and whatever he is engaging with, and the multiplicity of connections that exist beyond that. Throughout this conversation, he impresses the importance of engaging with real life and not just the screens that are in front of us, and seeing life as it truly is, whether that is indeed pleasant or not. He also suggests the importance of stepping out of ourselves and becoming more of ourselves, with how we perceive and connect with other life forms. This episode will give you so much to contemplate with regards to how, where, and with what we are spending our time, how we sense life, and the importance of not always putting humans at the center of the universe, and the humility and changes that occur within us when we make this shift. Look, I took so much from this conversation. David is not only a wealth of knowledge and experiences and senses, he also has an extremely captivating way of communicating as well. So I assume you're going to take as much from this episode as I did. And if you enjoy this conversation, please like, share, and subscribe. And if you're on the podcasting platforms, please continue to leave your lovely reviews, as I greatly appreciate your support at this stage of my podcasting journey. Please check out the notes on the show below if you want to check out David's most recent book or indeed his website. And also please check out my What is a Good Life newsletter at www.whatisagood.life if you want to get a further sense of my reflections on the conversations that you're listening to. And there's also means to contact me below in the show notes if you want to get in touch with me either for individual coaching, executive group coaching, or to hear about executive silent retreats that I'm offering as well. So having said all that, without further ado, the 67th episode of the What is a Good Life podcast. David, thank you very much for joining me today on the What is a Good Life podcast. Having been introduced to your work by a previous guest, I've been very much looking forward to the opportunity to speak with you today.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to join you. I'm looking forward to our chat.
Well, as I tend to kick these conversations off with David, it is with the question of, is there a question you're trying to answer as you move through life?
It's not so much a question as a process, maybe a celebration. I've tried in most of my professional work to raise up and celebrate and elevate and explore the stories of non-human beings, birds, soil, trees. And I've done that. I mean, I guess the most public-facing version of that are the books and the essays that I write about those, the audio experiences. But that's also true of my teaching. So mostly how I put bread on the table is by teaching American undergraduate students, and that's been in the areas of biology, especially field biology, going outside and learning to identify birds by sound or put your nose down in the mud and the moss and actually smell it for a change. All of those things for me, I mean, it's fun. It's educational. Students learn science and they learn about writing. But more than that is trying to put their imaginations and mine back where I think where they belong, which is not just wrapped up in human concerns, but in thinking about how we are related to and in relationship with other beings like trees and even unexpected things like mosses and earthworms.
When did this sense of celebrating non-human entities or relationships become of interest for you, David?
Well, it's hard to. I mean, when we look back on our lives, it's very hard to project particular narratives. And as a writer, I'm very aware of how we of the danger of doing that. Right. So when I was 7 years old, I had zero idea what I would be doing as a job or as my life. But looking back, I can see, oh, there was a kid who liked to grow vegetables in the garden. So I was sort of getting into the whole plant world there just because it was fun, not out of any sense of any mission. Or going, we had a pond at the bottom of the garden, at least one place we grew up. I used to poke around with a stick, and there were these algae that you could twirl around on the stick. And so it was a sort of, I wasn't trying to learn anything or be a biologist. I was just having fun. And a lot of the fun is the sensual, and I mean that in a non-sexual sense, like all the senses engaging with the world. So as a kid, I'd go around, like if we went into a shop, I'd be smelling the different spices, or go to the cheese section, which is kind of overwhelming, but wow, some really cool sensory impressions there. And so I always had that enthusiasm. I mean, I would say for probably the first half of my life, that enthusiasm didn't really have any kind of coherent core to it, which is fine, right? I mean, coherence is overrated. And then only lately I'd be, oh, I could use the sense of hearing or the sense of smell as a way of organizing some ideas and some invitations, some stories in books and in my classes and things. So again, with hindsight, I can say that as a kid, I was enthusiastic about those things. But, you know, I was also enthusiastic about riding my bike off a platform and crashing and stuff, you know, and luckily I haven't pursued a career in that, so which is, you know, probably good for my bones. But yeah, so that's, it is interesting. And I just said she was looking through my grandparents and great-grandparents stuff. They left a little bit of stuff that was in my mom's house, and I was there with my sister, and these are things I'd never seen. And seeing how, looking back to people I never met, seeing some of those projecting narratives backwards. Like, so my great-grandfather apparently was like really into gardening, and we've got his little cards for winning the second prize marrow at the garden show, you know, back in the 1950s. And he was someone who went through the First World War. And so I can imagine as an older man going into a garden and communing with his veggies was actually like, for me, it's meaningful, but for someone like him who went through some pretty hard times, wow, really, really. So I've been thinking a little bit about how across the generations some of these things echo.
That's a beautiful sense, isn't it? Like the idea of these echoing or reverberating or from through time. When you think of even that sense of it, of that echoing, what, like, where does your mind even wander with that? Or, you know, when you talk about the interconnectedness of things and whatever else, like, yeah, where would your mind even wander with that?
Well, a couple of places. The first is, you know, when I'm talking about my great-grandfather, I realize a lot of people don't know who their great-grandfather was, right? So in the U.S., histories of enslavement or other forms of injustice, or of, you know, for some parts of my family, I know some of the history, for others not, because of migration, dislocation. So I feel lucky in a way to be able to trace a little bit, you know, not a huge amount, but a little bit of our family history back, which gives me a sense of some of that intergenerational continuity. And I'm grateful for that, and don't receive that without acknowledging that you know, that that's in a way a luxury that many people don't have. The other intergenerational thing is, and this is maybe just a quirk of how my mind thinks, but I often think back to the Paleolithic. So, you know, not just my great-grandparents, but great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, right? 40,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, who, I mean, if we believe the archaeologists, these people back then had exactly the same kind of bodies and brains and all the rest as us. They weren't, quote unquote, primitive in any sense, fully human. And yet they were living without the technologies, of course, that we have. They were living just with stone tools, living mostly in an ice age where, particularly in Northern Europe, really challenging place to live. And then especially in the world where everything is like up in the air and discombobulated these days, and often in a very distressing way, there's a kind of stability in that view of deep time, which I find helpful. It doesn't answer any questions in the moment, but knowing that I have, and we all have kinship back to these people who are living in caves or in savannas, who were in deep relationship with the animals and plants around them. Like, to thrive, if you were back, you know, in the Aurig Nation 40,000 years ago, what did it mean to thrive? Well, it meant to, you know, understanding the medicinal qualities of the plants and dreaming about the animals so that you were a better hunter, but also a better neighbor and kin. I mean, people weren't just killing animals. They were living in community with them. And also, those people who had, by our standards, pretty hard lives, they were making art. They made flutes. They made three-dimensional sculptures, little figurines that they carved with their stone tools out of mammoth ivory and out of antler. Extraordinary things. And I find it very moving to see these, you know, in museums or just seeing a picture online or in a book. Wow. Making art, being creative, is a fundamental part of what it means to be human. It's not like an add-on when we've met all our basic needs. Suddenly we become creative and we want to make music or tell long sagas and stories. No, even right then at the beginning of humanity, if you like, tens, hundreds of thousands of years ago, people were making art.
Just, you know, when you use the word with your students, the word imagination, and then also this connection almost with the, like, a deep earthiness as well, like put your nose in the moss. It seems that, and then even just talking about our great, 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 great ancestors, and the fact that art wasn't this superfluous kind of thing you did when everything was in order. This is something innate within us. What do you kind of see then in terms of, I guess, like life and imagination and art in the sense of what we are?
Yeah, I think there are lots of different answers to that, but one of the things and you know, as my bias as a biologist and someone who writes about other beings, is to remember that all of those deeply human characteristics, like making art, happened in an ecological context. So what was it? What did people make figurines of back 40,000 years ago? Well, we've got one or two human figurines that might be goddesses or something. You know, we have no idea what. These are very plump, so-called Venus figurines. But the vast majority are not human depictions. They're of birds flying, of animals like bears and auroch and other creatures that people would have seen every day. And so when people started making art, they were like, let's celebrate the other, what I would call our kin, our sister brothers, the other animals, and to a lesser extent, the plants, because as far as we know, there are no carvings of plants, which to me is kind of disappointing. It's like, come on, ancestors, you're letting us down. The plants are important too. But maybe that, you know, next year some cool archaeological discovery will unearth a carved flower, which would be just totally blowing my mind. So a lot of this story of what it means to be human is to be human. Paradoxically, to be fully human is to be in relation to other beings. And then that's what I'm trying to bring to my teaching, with, particularly in a world where we're on digital media so much of the time, right, and being manipulated by that digital media. For me and for my students, it's just refreshing to go outside and, like, let's just see what the crows have got to say today. Let's smell the air. Let's put our fingertips on the trees and see what lessons and stories there are there, rather than having everything fed to us by a, you know, algorithms that are just trying to piss us off and keep our eyes on the screen, right? Which, you know, that's the fundamental nature of, and not the only thing that's going on in digital realm. But there is a sense of getting out of the human and smelling the soil, listening to the songs of the birds. It gets us out of ourselves, and paradoxically, we can be more fully ourselves because of that. Like, I at least feel more alive, more joyous, less anxious, less sad when I'm remembering, and I'm actually in physical sensory contact with other beings. Now, of course, we discover horrible things too, like, oh, this forest has been wiped out, or these birds are being poisoned. And so it's not like all all joy and celebration. But even in the grief, there's a kind of reality that feels necessary. If, in a way, it feels good to be in touch with the real world. And, you know, I spend my time writing on the computer. I use email. I'm on the social media. So I don't, you know, think that we need to completely unplug from all of that. And I do more and more think, particularly in education, the medium is the message, right? So if all our education is on a laptop, the fundamental lesson is that real life is the laptop.
Right.
If some of our education is on the laptop, but some of it is walking outside onto a street outside the school just to kind of look at the trees or, you know, look at the pigeons or whatever, there the medium is, oh, the real world is actually the world we should be concerned with. So there's, I mean, I don't want to get too sort of, you know, philosophical about the whole thing about the hidden messages of education. But it concerns me when I see more and more stuff just being keeping eyes on screens, because it's just like, we know that makes us more anxious. it doesn't help solve some of the big problems of the world, which is like extinction and ecological crisis and all those like really serious problems. But the solutions to those problems come through engagement with the living world, not just by thinking about it or doing a fancy statistical model on the computer.
You know, it's fascinating. The, you know, even our seeking of answers sometimes or solutions to life, how little of it seems to be in kind of feeling an answer or just perceiving the world through our senses. It's how can we ratchet up our thinking almost? And and I think, you know, just even what you noted there, I have this strong sense that like it's not about coming up with new answers. It's almost as much about remembering. And I think that there are certain processes that come alive, whether we're in nature or even just time away from a screen. Like I've had time where if I've been working for too long on the screen, like I almost feel my brain regenerate if I go out for a walk in the woods. Like I feel something is happening. And, you know, we're looking for all these really complicated answers to almost allow us to do the harmful things simultaneously while trying to cure ourselves. And I don't know, just from what you were saying there, it seems so apparent that we, the more that we create and disconnect ourselves from a natural sense, we're also struggling to find a natural sense of ourselves as well. So like there's a whole mixture of things going on simultaneously.
Yeah. And I mean, I do think that there's a sort of a generational change that is happening and not in a good direction. So if you, at least in the US, if you look at statistics on anxiety, say, people who are like a generation or two ahead of me in the, you know, like their 60s, 70s. Yeah, it's like maybe 10, 15%. But then as you get younger and younger, the level of anxiety goes up and up and up. Right? And so I think there's a disconnect with older generations maybe not understanding the way in which there are different lived human experiences happening at the same time in our society, right? So some people, and I, you know, I don't want to generalize about whole generations because I think that's a, you know, and set generations against one another. You know, we need more cross-generational conversation. But I do think, and this is an experience that may not be true everywhere, but certainly in the US, I feel like when I'm talking with, say, leaders of institutions and so on, we tend to be, you know, older people, they just, the sense that they don't realize that there's a whole other thing happening, and that is this pervasive sense of alienation from our own bodies and from maybe from one another that perhaps is mediated by digital stuff. Perhaps it's mediated by the fact that, you know, if you're 20 years old, you know you're going to have to live into the realities of climate change, whereas if you're 70, it's like, well, you know you're checking out within a few decades, so one way or another. So, and this is, I think, directly related to this coming back to the body. But we know that the more time you spend locked up in your own head, and especially if that thought patterns of your head are directed towards digital media, it increases levels of anxiety and the feeling of alienation. And going out to the more than human world, as that's a term from David Abram, who's a really fascinating philosopher who talks about the sensory nature of reality. The more we come back to our senses, the more we can find ourselves and heal ourselves from that process within. And it's not like, oh, looking at a pigeon is going to make your anxiety go away. However, a repeated practice of being in connection, if sort of open-ended, listening to the pigeons and the birds and just being fascinated by things like, you know, I'm drinking a cup of tea now. Well, and I used to just drink tea and it was just tea. Now I'm thinking, oh, that tea is a camellia plant, that somebody's hands picked those camellia leaves, maybe in India or China. And there's a history that goes back thousands of years of people wrapping their lives up with these camellia plants, you know, to give us a little caffeine and that nice tannic taste in the mouth. And of course, tea, I'm from England, and my family live in Scotland. So, you know, tea is the thing you do to gather people together, right? Not so much in the US, but you're sipping your tea now, your coffee, and connecting with a plant. And so for me, thinking about the network of connections in a simple act of drinking tea feels healing. It doesn't answer any questions or problems that I have, but I don't feel as alone. I feel literally in community with those plants and with the long cultural history of people using those plants. Also the brokenness of like when the British discovered tea and started clearing forests during the 19th century, they colonized India. Horrible human and ecological injustice was done in the sake of a cup of tea. So in no way does the sense of connection deny that. In fact, it connects us into that, realizing my cup of tea here, wow, there's some beauty, ecological beauty, but also deep human brokenness in that. And feeling actually connected to those stories, to me, is like reality. It feels centering and real compared to just going through life, not knowing where anything came from, feeling like I'm just a stranger to the whole freaking world. And I'm a stranger to myself as well. So you know, the tea plants and the pigeons help me triangulate to know who I am.
That's absolutely gorgeous. You know, the idea that I usually thought of before is, you know, connection to ourselves, connection perhaps maybe to nature, connections or influence of culture and how they, you know, family generations maybe and different things like that. But there's something about what you're pointing to here, which is like a deep paying attention to or awareness to of so many of the interdependencies, interconnections through time, in our environment, the implications, the effects that these have. And all of this is not to tell yourself a really lovely, comforting story. It's to go, no, look, there's, even in the example of tea there, there's something disturbing about this or troubling about this. And there's also something wonderful and connecting about this. And I don't know, I think in a world where I think connection is one of our biggest problems, like in terms of why we do a lot of the things that we do. And also even in terms of just the disconnection that we're that you're alluding to as well, that comes from technology that we're all feeling on some level. And I don't know, there's something really nice about what you're saying there is it's not to come up with a, therefore, QED and I have the answer for something. Mm-hmm. There's a comfort that comes with just engaging with reality, like a connection that perhaps that we're seeking, but also trying to avoid because of what it also tells us.
Right. And there's a sense of, I like that way of putting things. It's there's a sense also of living in ambiguity.
Oh, yeah.
So often we feel like we want to have an answer, like this person is good or bad, or this, here's the answer to this particular, you know, whatever it is in our own personal lives or in like the news that we look at. And yeah, and it's good to ask those questions, right? In some cases, there truly are things that we are called to do to help goodness happen in the world and to heal brokenness. But often there's ambiguity, like drinking a cup of tea. You know, is that good or bad? Well, it depends on the context. And there's a whole mix of beauty and brokenness in that one cup of tea. And being able to be in that ambiguity without denying the brokenness, but also without shutting ourselves off from the beauty, is something that I don't know if that's, to me, it feels valuable and helpful.
But even in our relationship with ourselves, that seems to be that capacity to handle our own ambiguity. We find that so hard to hold, I think. You know, the moment you said that, I thought of a personal relationship with myself, or how at times in life I could have judged myself very harshly, thinking that I have to become X before I deserve Y. But I think, like just what you're observing there, even when I observe nature, and I'm not pretending to be some avid observer of nature, but when I observe cycles, like even with a tree and the leaves appearing and disappearing, or if I go into a forest, I'm not judging a tree as being fat or tall or short. I'm just appreciating a tree. There's things that I think we can appreciate in just seeing cycles of life that help this human existence become a little easier. Even notions of death or an appreciation that an end could be coming. Like, there's something really beautiful about what you're saying there in terms of how we could handle that ambiguity, even just being a little kinder to ourselves.
Yeah, that's a, I hadn't really thought of those ideas in the context of ourselves, but having some compassion for ourselves is often the hardest place to to have the compassion, because we actually have to put it into action and live it. Like, it's, you know, fairly relatively easy to feel compassion for things that are at a distance for us and then go on a march or give some money to a cause and so on. But actually being gentle to oneself is an enormous challenge. And imagine if we could, how we would then be able to be a little gentler with one another. And I think, you know, this isn't my field, but I do think there's some sort of psychological evidence, sociological evidence, that the more people can connect to non-human beings, like a city park or seeing trees on the street or going out into the woods away from buildings. I mean, but it doesn't have to be away from cities, right into the city. That when we have those experiences, we actually do become more, quote unquote, pro-social. So we're more friendly to strangers. We have less, you know, fewer psychological barriers and judgments. It doesn't mean we're suddenly in love with everyone and it's all kumbaya, but it does mean that we're in this sense of openness and possibility that could be quite fruitful and generative. And of course, you know, the algorithms go exactly the opposite way, that bad news travels faster than good news in social networks, and that they monetize our outrage and divisions. And it's really only recently that I've come to realize the extent to which that has become a really powerful force in our societies. And I think it's so in a way, trees and pigeons and the soil might save us from ourselves by putting us back into touch with, you know, with our own being and making us more liable to just be friendly and cut one of each other some slack. You know, I could certainly do more of that. You know, I spend a lot of my time pretty angry about other people who have got the wrong political ideas and this and that. So, well, that's corrosive in a sense. And yes, I want to be voting for the right person and helping the right causes. But is there a way of doing that that is less sort of has less inner violence?
Just, and this may be a nonsensical question, so do push back or do label it as such. Is there, just from what you just described there, are there things you've observed in nature that would first come to mind for you that would actually, that would somehow not provide an answer, but even just allow the presence of that a little bit more peace in your sense of being?
I mean, I think partly the sense of peace is not so much what you observe, but is how the human body reacts to being around other beings. So smelling the smell of like fresh leaves in the springtime emerging from trees, those aromatic molecules actually go into our bloodstream and change the texture of our thoughts from the inside out. And so it's not so much that the tree is teaching me a lesson that then changes how I think. Is the tree is actually entering and becoming part of me and reshaping me from the inside, kind of in a subconscious way. And the same with, say, listening to the patterns of birdsong or connecting to the melodramas of birds. And I, you know, I keep coming back to pigeons, partly because I see a lot of them in cities. But you know, watching them do their little social displays to one another and then raise their babies in some nest on the edge of a drain pipe. It's better than what's like on the soap operas on TV, right? There's always some drama going on. There's always like big personalities happening. And there's a delight and a kind of fascination. And what, I mean, Iris Murdoch called this the process of unselfing, is that my thoughts and my feelings somehow become connected to them, even if it's only like for half a minute as I'm walking past them at, you know, on my way to a train or something. But in getting out of myself, then the self gets reconfigured without me even trying to do that. And I think that, to me, that's the really important but underappreciated, because it's open-ended. It's like letting your mind wander, and your mind can wander into new ways rather than having particular new thoughts. Because, say, thoughts in nature, you can read all sorts of narratives about like nature is red and tooth and claw, or nature is all about cooperation, or nature is totally immoral or amoral. People have laid all kinds of moral stories, either about cooperation or about conflict, into nature. And then in a way, they're all true. There's all those things are happening. As sensory beings who live in a conscious mind that emerges out of biochemistry that we don't fully understand in our bodies, connecting to non-human beings reshapes us, rewires us, molds the clay, changes the wet interior of ourselves in ways that I think are healing. And there's, you know, there's good psychological and immunological evidence that that's happening, but it manifests in that just a change in consciousness.
But, you know, I think there's something you said there that made me just think of the way in which we're trying to change ourselves, you know, if you want to call it self-development or trying to make ourselves better. It usually has an outcome in mind that we're trying to orient towards. Whereas in my experience, change happens all the time. And I'd even suggest that like maybe even the real change that's ever occurred in my life has been more consequential of an engagement with something that's changed me in a way that I could never have imagined it. But I've been, if I'm willing to let go of the of wanting to know or seeking the control over the final outcome. And so the way you're describing it there, it kind of makes me think that our problem with almost genuinely like allowing change to occur is that we wouldn't know where it goes. And you know, when you said earlier this idea that coherence is overrated or that we're fearful of ambiguity. There is something about this that I think that just made me think of just how we're how we're allowing ourselves to change. We're trying to control it too much. And it's kind of, we're becoming unnatural even in the process of our good intentions.
Yeah, that's a good point. In a way, Or maybe we're emphasizing one aspect of our nature too much, right? Which is the rational planning mind, which is great. I mean, it's a good thing to have some plans and some schedules and goals and things like that. But and this I've learned mostly by as a writer. So I'm writing a chapter about, you know, a particular tree, or how birdsong reflects cool stories about the past. I have a whole set, you know, I could write a chapter outline. It's like, okay, this idea A is going to lead to B, to C, and so on. And that's great. But then I'll go for a walk, and I'm not thinking about that chapter. I'm just like, you know, getting some fresh air, getting some exercise, whatever, going out with a friend. And then suddenly things sort of come together. Oh, I never realized that these strands that I'm trying to write about fit together in a completely different way. Or that the whole chapter is just nonsense, and let's just write something about this other story that I didn't even know that there was there were connections there. So, and that comes from the practice of letting the grip of the mind. You know, when I've had companion dogs in my life, you know, they like to play tug of war, right? They grab one end of the stick and pull and pull. And my mind feels like that sometimes. I sink my teeth into something and I just won't let go. At a certain point, that's all right, you know, if you're trying to get something done. But then you have to have this place where you let the jaw relax and just think about some other things and let the body relax. And weirdly, paradoxically, in giving up and not thinking about it, you actually make more progress thinking about a particular problem. And again, that's sort of instrumentalizing the value of open-ended play and mind wandering. But like in school, if you're sitting there just like looking out of the window, the teacher's going to tell you off, right? Because you're daydreaming. But, well, maybe in school we should have, you know, for every class period of time where it's just there are no goals and no activities, it's just daydreaming. Which, of course, immediately our instinct is then to pull out the phone to get some stimulation. And what we need to, I think, is for at least for creative practices, is have some times where no, we put the phone away, we put the book down, we stop, and we just kind of letting ourselves get a little bored and see where the mind wanders to. And I'm kind of fidgety, so for me it really helps to be in motion, and I can daydream when I'm going for a walk or a run or something like that. My mind has all kinds of places, and I'm not trying to direct it. If I'm sitting just on the sofa doing that, I mean that's more of a meditative practice and it's more challenging. But luckily our legs set that 1-2 rhythm, boom, boom, boom. It's like a music we're kind of grooving to as we're walking down the street. And out of that bodily musical experience of a very simple 1-2 beat, suddenly our thoughts get activated by that. It's, you know, it's very primal. I mean, I don't know, you know, I have no clue what other animals experience in their minds, but surely when a horse is galloping or a squirrel is scurrying up a tree, there's sort of a sense of bodily wholeness that frees whatever a squirrel or horse mind is to explore new places.
Have you ever given serious contemplation as to what a horse might be thinking? I know that sounds very odd, but I just... Yeah.
No, I have, I think, ultimately, you know, the best philosophers and scientists have not been able to answer that question, but I don't think that means then that we shouldn't ask it, because it's a basis of empathy, right? And of like, if we think the horse is just a machine, then we're basically free to torture it, do all kinds of horrible stuff. But if we believe the horse has an inner experience that is going to be, of course, different from the human inner experience, just as human skin and hair is different from horse skin and hair. But the experience is my own position on that is it seems pretty likely that all these other beings, particularly vertebrate animals, have an inner experience. Like if I drink a whole load of beers, or take anesthetic, or drink too much coffee, the texture of my mind completely changes. So we know that the human conscious experience emerges from the biochemistry of our cells. And then when we look at dogs and slugs and so, you know, they've got nerves that are basically the same as ours, except they're arranged in slightly different configurations. So why wouldn't this product of nerves, the human subjective experience that we call consciousness, be present in other beings as well? And if it is, you know, we really fall pretty short on the sort of ethical scheme of things. I mean, some ways that we raise pigs and chickens and so on, I think are just appalling. And, you know, I eat meat. I'm not, at various times I've been vegetarian, but now I eat meat. I try and buy it from places that treated animals with some dignity and respect. But that's a hard thing to do, because we live in, of course, in a culture where it's hard to know where your meat came from, unless you try really hard and often it's more expensive. So just being empathetic gets challenging in a way that, like, you know, our ancestors just wouldn't have. They're just like, what the heck are you people? You know, you knew where your meat came from because you'd hunted it, right? Or you'd raised it yourself or traded it. And it says really only in the last few generations, almost with a living memory, that our food system has transformed so much. So that's where I actually think about those questions the most, is what I eat. Because thinking about a horse or a squirrel is one thing, and it's kind of an interesting imaginative exercise. But thinking about bacon and beef and chicken, that is like really real, and it's something that I face several times a day, because, like, what am I having for lunch?
The moment you said that, like, I honestly had like a jolting experience of I don't know, someone I interviewed in some of the private interviews a long time ago, they were talking about listening to the water. And I just almost had this like freakish, like, or just this restrictive action of just thinking, what would the waters be screaming at us with what we're putting into it? And then just when you mentioned consciousness of animals in that sense, like, look, I have a dog. I have absolutely no doubt that we have a very clear understanding of each other, and she observes me very closely and is very conscious as to what our preferences and all sorts of different things. I think once again, if we were to listen into some of these, or even just have some of these thoughts, even if it were just in the imaginative space, I think they're good sense checks, like just like you with your cup of tea and just being aware of where the whole, the various ways or areas in which that can play out. Like, I think some sort of sense of not looking at the human being as at the center of all of the universe would be pretty helpful for us.
Yeah, I love that way. But, you know, we're not in the middle of everything, and that's, you know, that's humility. That isn't self-effacing or self-degrading kind of humility, but a kind of humility that is deeply respectful of the fact that we're other beings are here with us. Now, as a biologist, I and that the last 150 years of biology have not been helpful in that regard. So we've tended to think of the fundamental unit of life as the individual gene, the individual species, the individual organism. And, you know, and that's a helpful way of looking at things sometimes. But now what people are realizing, individuality is just a manifestation of relationship and interconnection. So the human body is comprised of human cells, of course, but every human cell has ancient bacteria living within it. So our own cells are made out of relationship. And then we have the whole microbiome, all the different bacteria and viruses and fungi in our gut, and then our skin that help us develop and texture our thoughts. And so we realize that what we thought was an individual solitary human is actually a living community. And then our minds, of course, are always produced by interconnection with others. But this is true for other beings as well. A tree leaf, like it, just an ordinary maple leaf. Inside the leaf, it's full of little bacterial and fungal cells that help protect the leaf from pathogens, help the leaf deal with drought. So a tree, even though it looks like a very stout individual, is also a living community. And so we need, as biologists, this sort of revolution that I think is happening now, and that I've tried to write about for one way or another in my books, this revolution is getting away from an individualistic way of thinking into thinking that all of life is about relationship and interconnection, and that those points of individuality, like my individual consciousness that I'm experiencing now, are manifestations of what's deeper and more fundamental, which is relationship. And again, that to me is a kind of is a lesson in humility. Is that it can't be all about me, because me is in fact diffuse and is a product of community. And of course, most religious traditions have had a lot to say about the relationship between the self and the community, whether you call that community God or something else. And, I have very little insight into any of that, but I do think in biology, the study of life in its physical and chemical manifestations, it's extraordinary just in the last, say, 20 years, how the study of genetics and the study of ecology and the physiology have completely changed to be all about networks and network relationship. And the whole old school way of thinking about individuals, although, again, as I said, it can be very useful, it only captures a very small part of the reality that we can, you can measure in the lab. This isn't mysticism. It's stuff that people are measuring in a physical, ecological, chemical way.
Do you think that that's, does that give you cause for... I'm not trying to say optimism. I understand some of the things that we're facing in life, but does that give you the sense that we're either starting to ask the right questions, or we're starting to shift our perspectives to ways in which maybe could be more helpful, or that are at least maybe influenced by the sense of lack of what we have in our life, a lack of network, a lack of relationships, these kind of things?
Yes. I mean, I do think that it's really helpful to have scientific ways of thinking and even economic ways of thinking shifting to this way of thinking about relationships, because now how that plays out politically and in terms of economic and power structures in our society, that's a place where we should all be concerned. But I do think that the networked idea of life is one that is more likely to make us good neighbors, more likely to make us good community builders locally, but also globally. As people think about what does it take to deal with the climate crisis or to have sustainable human and ecological societies. Coming at those questions from an individualistic point of view is really, we can get so far, but coming at it from a networked view where relationship is a fundamental stuff of life is a lot more helpful. I mean, the other thing that makes me hopeful is that seeing how these questions are right at the heart of a lot of what people are very activated around politically is great. I mean, I was an undergrad back in the 1980s, and I used recycled paper, and I was like laughed at. And nobody cared about climate. I mean, a very small number of people were concerned about global warming, as it was called back then, and so on. But it was like the idea that this could be a major international issue, and that forest conservation could be right at the center of major international treaties. And admittedly, we have not done as much as we should, not by a very long shot. That I take hope in the fact that in a few decades, we've moved what were extremely peripheral concerns right to the center of things is very hopeful. It doesn't make me feel, it's at the center of things, but how these debates will play out, I think, is very uncertain. And so I think our, for at least to myself, I tell myself, it's not my job to think whether I'm going to be optimistic or pessimistic. It's my job to figure out what can I contribute in a positive way that will tip the balance in the direction of beauty and of wholeness and of interconnection and away from brokenness and suffering. And if we all ask that question, do it collectively, you know, we have a hope of making some progress. Does it guarantee that the world isn't going to end in some nuclear war or climate disaster? No, of course it doesn't. But it's like, well, we don't know that. We can't predict that. No one on the planet can predict that. We can spin optimistic and horribly pessimistic tales out of current affairs. But in a way, it's kind of disempowering to take. It's more I like to think about, okay, well, where do I and my community and my work and life fit into this? And how can I help as I can? You know, I've got my things I can do, but of course, working with other people in relationship is far more necessary.
You know, when you mentioned the idea of looking at our, ancestors 40,000 years ago and still seeing the prevalence of art, and almost the way I think sometimes society may look at art now is something superfluous or something that you just isn't necessarily an essential part of us. I also find it really interesting that there seems to be a reawakening to the idea that we need relationships in our life, which it makes me laugh almost saying it, just considering how fundamental they are to what I perceive to be our well-being. And, you know, when I've interviewed all these people for this project, it wasn't to come up with a new top five list of ways to live life, but it was more just, can we look at the landscape of our lives and can you tell me what you think is important kind of thing? And obviously, relationships proves to be almost the only universal answer that people touch on in these discussions. And I think that there's something really hopeful about that. But then also in the way that you're describing, I think can we just look at things as they are, not to give us a specific answer or a solution, but also even just in recognizing that relationships are so important to us. Also just that we could be doing ourselves a kindness in just realizing what's causing us so much harm. You know, like, and even bringing that back to the micro level of an individual person trying to figure out maybe their own, their own complexity or their own ambiguity, that there's something like that just requires us, that's just going to require us just to look. And whether that's on the macro or the micro, I don't know. I just think [S2] Right. [S1] That the idea of even just becoming more aware again of the significance of relationships, it's amazing what we can start to miss when we stop looking, [S2] Right. [S1] you know?
Yeah. And those relationships, I think, are both the seen relationships, like people we know, or the trees that grow outside our houses or a apartment block, or the cats and dogs in our lives, but also the unseen relationships, like the cup of tea connecting me to the soils and the story of camellia plants, and also British colonial history and all its brokenness. And I think that's what, in a way, art can do, is it draws us together. Say, when we're listening to music, we draw together with other people because we're listening to a band together, or we're enjoying like sacred music in a church service, or romantic music when we're dining. All of these, the music allows us to connect. And of course, we're connecting also, though, beyond what we can perceive, into the artistry of the composer or the songwriter. We won't know those people, right? But we're connecting to the shape of their imaginations in that way. And we're connecting to the wood in the violin or in the soundboard of the piano, and the algae that were mined as oil and turned into an electronic keyboard. All of these experiences of art connect us immediately, but then out in concentric layers in this web that goes out into the living earth. And I think that's one reason why art, whether it's listening to music or seeing visual art or reading and listening to interesting stories, why art transforms us and is so nourishing to us is that there's an immediate connection, but then there are also these diffuse webs of interconnection. And I feel more whole when I feel like I belong to something bigger than myself, like a living earth where there are camellia plants and living rivers, and that some of those connections I'll never know about. But the few that I do help me sort of weave a strand of belonging rather than of alienation.
And it's not even just with the liveliness of how you're describing that, but I just think that there's something enriching about life, the way if we're not just labeling something as inanimate or dead or non-human or not human, like there's just the more we're tuned into either the connections or the sheer vast aliveness all around us, I think that has a profound effect just on our on how we experience this world or how we even treat each other as well.
Yeah.
There's, you know, just I'm looking at the time and just from so many of the things that you've described in this, like, you know, even just the coming into contact with real life, the feeling life through our sensing life again through our senses, like whether it's a student putting their nose in the ground, ideas of engaging with imagination, and an awareness of our interconnectedness, the relationships between us, the idea of even just appreciating our beauty and our brokenness, the sense as well of just even that you mentioned, like the celebration of life, like there's things to celebrate in the interconnection, and whether it's in the non-human sense of the non-human focus as well, and just the appreciation of so much beyond what we consider to be maybe generally what we may consider to be important in life, but these like beauty, these values, these connections, and then also just the awareness that some things in life that we maybe think of as just our nice add-ons are actually inherent part of the human experience, be, you know, particularly art, as you've just alluded to again there. I've so many more questions that I would have loved to have asked you, David, because it had gone in so many different ways. But just to ask you the question, David, of what is a good life for you?
I think part of a good life is for me to pay attention. And for me, that's with my intellect, my creativity, but especially with my senses. So to go through a life, you know, we only get a few years on this planet, and it's full of extraordinary diversity of experiences. And so to shy away from those or to shut oneself off is sort of to shun a gift. And so I really do try to smell my cup of tea as I'm drinking it, because I think that's an act of gratitude. And the other thing for a good life, and I do think I'm fairly good at smelling my cups of tea, but in a more challenging part of a good life is, can I, in my own work and my life, draw together some of these strands of connection and relationship in ways that are creative and generative? I mean, for me, but more for other people. So that when I'm gone, that network of connections, that web of strands, will be woven in a slightly more productive, fruitful way, maybe a more beautiful way, in a less broken way. And so that's I think of writing and teaching as partly doing that, is of being a weaver. And of course, a weaver then leaves, as I will leave this planet at some point, but what's left behind is something that is useful but also beautiful.
That sounds like a very good life to me then, David. There's something so beautiful though about the sense of the, like, not you were saying earlier, not necessarily providing solutions, but just the being able to observe the interconnections, or being able just to help us, I think, to appreciate, almost to feel life and feel life more deeply, or as you're saying there, to pay in paying attention and sensing life more deeply. I think that sometimes in our rush to solve life, it's also just in feeling the experience of life that helps us be able to observe some of these interconnections that you're alluding to as well. Look, David, I just want to say thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed the conversation with you. And so thank you very much for joining us on the What is a Good Life podcast today.
Great. Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you for the weaving of ideas and these really important questions that you do.